Welcome to Behavioral Health Today, a podcast by Triad Behavioral Health, covering trending topics in behavioral and mental health. This podcast is designed to share unique and relevant topics occurring within the world and our communities and bring them a mental health perspective.
Welcome to Behavioral Health Today. I'm your host, Dr. Graham Taylor, and I'm joined by Dr. Adrian Lowe today in the studio. Adrian is the co-founder and CEO of the International Spine and Pain Institute. Adrian earned both an undergraduate and a master's degree in research and spinal surgery rehabilitation from the University of Stellenbosch in Cape Town, South Africa. Adrian shares his 28 years of physical therapy and pain science experience as a professor, professional speaker, author, and in his clinical practice. Adrian, welcome to Behavioral Health Today. We're sure glad to have you here.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So nice to be with you. You know, today we're talking about your work with behavior and the details of clinical treatment using this telemental health platform. And when we're talking about pain, we know that it's a complex area both to understand and to treat. So what I'd like to do just at the beginning of our time is, if you would please, define for us the psychology of pain and why we hurt.
Well, I think you should ask a psychologist that, right?
I'm asking you.
Yeah, pain is complex. I think that's the easy thing to say, right? In the old days, we thought of pain as a very simple linear experience. I punch you in the arm and you experience pain and that's it. You know, we now know pain is way more complex. There are psychological aspects of it. There are emotional, social, etc. The human pain experience, we're getting such a deep understanding now with things like functional MRI, brain scans, etc., that we know this distributed network of events that occur between our ears, and the brain basically puts a threat appraisal to it. And In my world, pain and injury is synonymous. If you hurt yourself, you're going to get pain. And if you have pain, you did hurt yourself. And we know that's a fallacy. It's not true. We know there's a high percentage of people that have an injury and no pain.
That's right.
I mean, you and I have noticed blood in our body or a bruise and thinking, where did that come from? And then we have to go back and think and go back to our memory and think, oh, that happened 3 days ago. I was so busy watching LeBron playing a game and I was distracted. On the flip side, we know we are dealing with a pain epidemic where people are struggling with severe pain and we scan them and we cannot find anything wrong. Right. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It's very, very real. So pain and injury is two different concepts. Mm-hmm. And in my world, unfortunately, the orthopedic pain world, those two have been blended. Injury means pain means injury. And my psychology friends would take it to another level where we haven't even remotely explored the emotional aspects of pain, which contributes so much to it, which my profession has to learn a lot more about.
Got it. Very good. You're talking about bringing in other folks, psychologists included, and I'm sure there's others, you know, treating pain and its relationship with behavioral health really is best done, it sounds like you're saying, with multidisciplinary team approach. Give me a sense of the various professionals that typically might make up a collaborative approach to working with a patient in pain.
Yeah, there's definitely layers. But if you look at the current best evidence, no matter where you look at it, for chronic pain, it consists of three things. We got to change how people think. Okay. And the thinking part is things traditionally like cognitive behavioral therapy. Okay. Neuroscience education, acceptance therapy, you know, anything to change how that human being is thinking. The second part relates to movement. No matter how you look at it, and you can call movement different things. It can be Pilates, yoga, aerobic exercise. We got to move the human being. And the third thing is we got to calm your nervous system down. The calming down, there's a medical branch, which relates to things like anti-seizure medications, your antidepressants. But then there is non-pharmacological ways, meditation, mindfulness, all these really cool strategies. So when I think multidisciplinary, I think who can do that for me? So on the cognitive side, yeah, sure. Therapists, any healthcare provider can probably provide some level of cognitive retraining, but it gets beyond our scope at some point, right? So I have to have my psychologist. I have to have a psychiatrist when my psychologist cannot and I cannot help them. And then we can have other levels of our social workers, our counselors, right? This is a tiered system. So that's that side. The movement side, that's easy. That's physical therapy, occupational therapy, chiropractic, athletic training, personal training, the list goes on, right? Any movement specialist. And then the calming side is cool because now we can bring in our colleagues like nutrition specialists, people that have specialized training in yoga, martial arts, etc. So if you look at it big picture. And obviously, let's just be sure, there's got to be somebody to handle the medicine side, which yes. would be a well-meaning physician, physician assistant, nurse practitioner that can help us with that. So in most of the bigger centers, that's the idea behind it. The more complex pain gets, the more help we need from our psychology friends, no doubt about it.
I'd like to go down that path in just a moment, but something you said regarding the ways that we think and believe about our pain, the impact it can have, but something you said almost sounds counterintuitive. Somebody in pain, you want to get them in motion. I've heard you talk before, and you talk about motion is lotion. And this whole idea, if I heard that right, and this whole idea that actually getting the blood flowing and the oxygen flowing to those areas that are in pain for the person can actually help have a medicinal effect in many ways. So it's almost counterintuitive. Get into motion when you're in pain. Help me understand that.
Yeah. So we do know this. And I apologize again, if somebody's listening, they're in pain, they're going to probably get mad at me, but because I'm going to take it to an extreme for you. We now know that a 6-mile run produces 10 milligrams of morphine in the brain. Yes. And that is significantly higher than if you broke your arm today and went to the emergency room, they're going to give you 2 or 3 milligrams of morphine. Aerobic exercise turns the brain's chemistry on. The brain is producing these incredible endogenous mechanisms that calms us down. The problem is a person in pain, movement equals pain. They have that belief. When I move, I hurt. And when I hurt, I move. So the most dangerous person they can see is the physical terrorist, right? Which is me, the physical therapist. And so they won't move. If I change how they think, and that allows him to move, we win, right? And so again, it brings us back to that dichotomy. When I move, I must be hurting something, so I should stop moving.
Yes.
So we now know in the last 10, 15, 20 years, there is an enormous volume of evidence to show us that one of the biggest reasons human beings hurt is that our nervous system ramps up and becomes sensitized.
Yes.
So one of the reasons why you cannot move is because your alarm system, that we use as a metaphor, ramped up. And so if we can explain that to somebody and they understand, oh, so just because I feel my back or my leg when I move doesn't mean it's broken or it's injured. It's just sensitive. Correct. Yes. So we teach them sore but safe. Hurt doesn't equal harm. Now, just for 1 second, I want to step back because we do very due diligence to make sure there isn't something wrong. Because I can hear it screaming on the other side. Yeah, but you don't understand. I got a bad this or that. Right. So we go through a screening process, and if we cleared all the scary things, I can retrain the patient to understand that pain partly is because of a sensitized system.
Yes.
And then we teach them how to move with pacing and graded exposure. You know, the number one mistake people make in movement is all or nothing. We're Americans, so guess what? If little bit is good, more is better. So we want everything supersized tomorrow.
Yes.
So the biggest mistake, people go as hard as they can and they crash, hard crash. We call that the boom bust cycle. And you know, and your audience would know that what we do is, you know, you eat the elephant one bite at a time. So walk for 2 minutes, come back and say, how did that feel? Fantastic. All right, tomorrow we do 3, the next day 4.
Got it.
We pace you back. So that's the essence of it.
Really good. So that whole educational process. So it goes back to this idea that what a person thinks and what they believe has a direct impact and actually drives and can drive their pain experience. So we know that we can, in fact, if taught, influence the way that a patient thinks about their pain. In other words, really you're saying the brain is a big determiner in one's pain experience. And given this, if we can actually teach people about their pain, can't we, such that this understanding can alter their pain experience and begin to change their relationship with their pain experience. Can you go into that just a wee bit more for us? Because this sounds very hopeful at the very front end, at the educational piece.
Absolutely. First of all, pain is 100% produced by our brain. No brain, no pain. And what I mean by that is the brain must be involved in the scenario. Rene Descartes gave us the mind-body split 300 plus years ago, but the brain is critical. The brain produces all our happy chemicals anyway, so we need to target the most powerful thing we can, which is the brain. Yes. We have a plethora of research right now to show we can change people's beliefs. This is many studies we have done. And when people change how they think, there are very neat consequences in terms of movement, behavior, et cetera.
Yes.
This is the essence of cognitive behavioral therapy. Yes. Unfortunately, I think behavioral therapy, in my humble opinion, has moved very much to the behavioral part, and we've kind of skimped on the cognitive. Let's change how you think.
Yes.
So in the last few years, we built this thing called pain neuroscience education, which is a fancy term for we teach you the latest science of how pain works. And we have, first of all, we figured out patients can understand it. I mean, this is the most complex neuroscience we've ever seen on the planet, that we put in simple stories and metaphors. And you know, I'll just tell you the neatest project we're working on right now, we've got about 6-7 papers done, that we are teaching this for middle school children in America, how pain works. And then it drastically changed their behavior. And we've done this in the VA, we've done this in Department of Defense, we've done it for patients. So this thing works. This isn't about me, our research. We scan people's brains before, after. We can see the outcome. So yes, if we change how they think about pain, that pain isn't an enemy. The problem is we always see pain as the enemy, right? Pain is a bad thing. Yes. So I'm gonna ask you a question, if you don't mind.
No, please.
Name me some good pains in this world.
Yeah, good pain is after I have a workout, my muscles are sore, but it tells me I had a great time.
And you did something good for yourself, correct?
Absolutely.
So we always see pain as the enemy, right? But we know things like childbirth, and again, you know, I never experienced, never will, but ladies will tell us painful, yet one of the most amazing days of their life.
Yes.
Workout pain. Adrian is a little fat and lazy. I start working out, and I come back and say, you know what? I'm sore, but I know I'm doing something good.
Yes.
Sharp. If I poke myself or a hot stove, it teaches me something.
Yes.
Pain is not bad. Pain is a good thing. It protects us. But when pain does its job too well, it becomes a barrier to movement. And that's the essence of this hypervigilant nervous system, if you will. And all I'm saying is we have trained people this, so where they fundamentally go, I got it. And when they got it, they move better. They actually experience less pain, less disability. They spend less money on healthcare. We have 7 systematic reviews, meta-analyses that says this thing actually works. And so it's really cool for us to look at it. Yeah.
I really like the idea that people unknowingly develop kind of a way of thinking and believing such that they think this is the way that my pain is best understood. I can feel it. I know it. I have an intimate relationship. And my whole life can literally get shaped around, or even bent, if you will, physically or just mentally around this. And what you're talking about is introducing another way, not just to understand it, but slowly and sequentially introducing another experience they can have that really challenges what they've been living in or have been kind of trapped in their bodies and their thinking. I would imagine at first there's some dissonance and some challenge around that. You want me to do what? Exercise? Really? Come on.
Yeah, that's only after they say, oh, you think it's in my head.
Right, exactly. That's right.
So I'm going to give you a beautiful quote by my mentor, David Butler, that says the art of explaining pain to patients is to tell them it's in their head without telling them it's in their head. Huh. And what I mean by that, your pain is real. I want the audience to 100% understand. I'm a neuroscientist. We scan people's brains. We do all those. We have never scanned fake pain. Mm-hmm. And I would encourage, I don't know if your audience or patients included, et cetera, but I always tell my patients, if somebody tells you your pain is not real, you have my blessing to stand up and fire that healthcare provider. They don't deserve you. The pain is real. Just because we don't understand it makes it different, right? But the point being that very simply, pain is real. And if you understand more about it, you're less afraid of it. And that's why we teach our students, pain that is understood is not to be feared. And I mean, come on, in the psychology world, Johan Vlayen and Steve Linden's iconic work in 2001 on the fear avoidance model shows us the fear of pain is worse than pain itself. Mm-hmm. And if we can alter fear by understanding, then people will move. And
I really like that.
In my profession, I can sell that any day on anywhere.
That is really good. I know you've done some work with behavior and virtual reality, digital medicine. We had Aaron Ghani join us in one of our earlier podcasts. Aaron is the founder, as you know, and CEO of Behavior, which is an online company that creates digital therapeutics for behavioral health. And Behavior's approach to improving health incorporates both the mental and the medical components, incorporating virtual reality such that one's, like you're saying earlier today, one's cognitions, their emotional and physiological, neurological responses are activated in a very unique and effective way. I'd love to hear more about your work with them and kind of how you see this program really being effective in pain management.
Yeah, this is interesting. You know, we do know that there is a lot of work that's been done in virtual reality for pain.
Yeah.
But the treatments have always been distraction. So I'm going to keep your brain busy while somebody cuts on your leg. The classic example comes from Hunter Hoffman's work in Washington, which is mind-blowingly awesome. He built a program, Snow Globe, for soldiers that would go into the snow globe environment while they debriefed wounds from these wars that they were in. Wow. And it works fantastic. We're just saying the opposite. If we're teaching you about pain, why don't we take that teaching experience and supersize it?
Yes.
The one thing we have now shown is when you experience pain, pain becomes more chronic over time, which means, long story short, it goes towards your emotional areas of your brain.
Yes.
And when pain gets into the emotional circuitry, it becomes way more entrenched and difficult. The virtual reality allows people to learn, but also engaging the emotional parts of the brain more than just sitting in a clinic with me across the table. Mm-hmm. Let me teach you how pain works. So we're exploring that and we're getting really good results. With this, we then add components of breathing, mindfulness, meditation, so they can have these real vivid experiences that activates the areas of the brains we really want to target. And the reality is, you know, the young kids, which my students, this is how they're going to learn in the future. And so we're a little bit ahead of the curve. We got really good data. We're getting there. A lot of pre-op surgery centers are interested in this right now. So yeah, it's probably futuristic, but it's getting there. We got good results. It's going to be interesting.
I'd love to hear a little bit about some of the clinical parts and the engagement in that, but tell me just a moment. You said something about, you know, this mindful, meditative kind of developing awareness, and that's really counter to what most folks want to do or what's typically been taught: distraction, getting busy, avoidance, not thinking about. So you're actually encouraging people to learn how to both understand their pain and then lean into it through that awareness, through that meditative kind of conscious state that they get in. Say a wee bit more about that part.
Yeah, it's probably a combination of both. So yes, on the one side, we want people to understand what's going on with them biologically, the cognitive part. But then we also want to activate various other biological systems. We now know the research on mindfulness is exploding exponentially in calming the nervous system down, getting some of our sympathetics to calm down. So there's also that calming effect that these treatments can do. But they also make you more aware of your own body, your internal feelings, how you feel, etc. It's going to be very important. We cannot dissociate you from your body. It's actually the opposite. You want to become more aware of your body, but in that awareness, you also understand what's going on from the cognitive. So it's a blend of the two.
Yes.
But most of the times in our programs, the mindfulness meditation is to calm the system.
Yes.
That they understand what's going on.
Yeah, I really like that. I'd love to hear if you could share with us maybe a clinical example of bringing all of this together with a patient you've worked with, from the cognitive piece, the behavioral piece, being in motion, them understanding. It sounded like they'd walk away empowered, ideally, and in control of their pain rather than their pain being in control of them. It sounds like some of the locus of control shifting from external to internal begins to occur in very, very meaningful ways. Give us a story. About a patient that kind of exemplifies all these things you're pulling together for us.
I mean, wow, where do we start?
So,
I mean, a patient that definitely stands out for me, my students will recognize because they talk about it all the time. But I literally had this lady walk in, 20 years of chronic back pain, hasn't moved, has seen everybody, right? We know the grocery list, 7 doctors, 9 chiropractors, 8 PTs, the list goes on. And barely would move. Now, if you understand it, I'm a therapist. My life is built on movement.
Yes.
And no matter what skill technique, she wouldn't let me touch her. So I already have a problem. I cannot physically touch her to do some manual technique or physical treatment. She wouldn't move for me because pain equals movement. She's tied together. And all I did with this patient, as an example, I would sit with her. And my favorite question, by the way, for any patient is, why do you think you hurt? Didn't you see my MRI? I have a bulging disc.
Right.
And then we just start delving into that. Well, tell me about a bulging disc. What do you understand that is? Who told you this? When was this planned on? And we deconstruct this and then very carefully in an environment of compassion and empathy. I really care about you. I started giving her some information about how MRIs and back pain don't always add up, carefully not pushing her. And then telling her a story, we talk about the sensitive alarm. And we could use a dry erase board and draw her that our body's nervous system works like an alarm system. It's buzzing along, enjoying a beautiful day. And did you hurt your back? Absolutely. You remember the day, the time you bent over, you felt a pop in your back. The alarm system ramped up, ding, 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 go get some help. In most of our lives, the alarm system will beautifully calm down and we're good. But 1 in 4 people, the alarm comes down and decide to rest at an extra sensitive level. Now, only a little bit of movement, ding, 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 the alarm goes off. So we tell the story of a sensitive alarm. And in all the years I've done this, patients, the number one question they ask me is, how do I turn the alarm down? Now, the neat thing is, A, she didn't ask me how do I fix the disc. So I moved her from the tissues to the alarm.
Very good.
And if she asked me how do I calm her down, there is about 24 things I can do in any rehab to help her calm her down. Mindfulness, meditation, movement. I mean, the list goes on.
Yes.
And then talk about all these beautiful strategies. And I will never forget, because we published it actually as a case study, I then, after this lady understood, so what you're saying is, I am hurting. I said, yes, but it's not just because of the disc. I said, no, it definitely had a piece to do with it, but it's not all of it. Oh.
Yes.
And I said, would you mind standing up for me? And I said, sure. I said, would you mind bending over again? I'll never forget. She went a few degrees forward. She stopped. And then she went all the way to the floor. Like, whoa. I said, what happened? Yes. She said, oh, I'm just sensitive.
Huh.
I said, what about your bulging disc? She said, well, everybody has them. And it's a silly example. And I can imagine people on the other side of this recording going, but you don't understand.
Yes.
This is complex. But she understood. And I want to also emphasize, she didn't only understand, but I was listening. There was a safe environment. She felt like she could talk to me. Now, we then took her out to the gym area in our clinic and we said, now let's get, you know, motion is lotion. Let's get your system moving. Let's get some blood flow. Yeah, but when I move, I hurt. So we had a conversation. Yes. And she said, and I said, well, where do you think you can start? Do you think 5 minutes is okay? Nah, that's too much. How about four? No, that's how about three? Until she like, I feel good there. I feel safe. And we did a little bit. How's that feel? We're good. Is that all we're doing? Yeah, we're good. We have success. So we build upon success. So this is just a simple example, but she stood out for me because she was the reason I decided to do my PhD in neuroscience, because she blew my mind.
That's fantastic. Think about,
right? As a movement therapist, I changed how somebody think and it changed her life.
Yes.
And it just blew my mind. I'm like, I got to learn more about this stuff.
What really stands out to me, and that is the importance at the very beginning of both a trusting relationship and allowing her to experience sequentially and manageably small steps towards a goal. I always think of trust as two things, information and time. Yeah. So over time, I gather information and I have to relearn something. And sometimes that information that I learn can't help but challenge what I've long believed or set my life up around, in this case, pain. And what you're doing in a very encouraging, very patient way is to say, want 5 minutes? No, how about two? Let's try two. And just to see that two works and information over time lets me get to five and see that, wow, I can actually do this. But I think that relationship is a real key piece. So both patiently there and introducing information over time allows that trust for the person to see that I can do these things in ways that I never thought I could. And maybe my mind, like you're going back at the beginning, has been limiting me. Little did I know that I can actually do these things and maybe tolerate some things that I didn't believe I could do before. That is awesome.
Yeah, you know, this reminisce of Theodore Roosevelt's quote, which my students have to recite. People don't care how much you know until they know how much you care.
Yes.
And I find a lot of my healthcare providers, they get excited when we train them. They run in the room and they throw everything at you. And they come back and say, but it doesn't work. I said, but did the patient know you care? Did you listen?
Yes.
And these things are very important. People in pain are hurting. Our medical system has not done a job well with them. They are hurting, they're unheard, and it's a very big part of it, no doubt about it.
Yes.
And so I agree with you 100%.
I think there's almost an unintentional, I don't want to say necessarily antagonistic, but almost a disbelief that comes in, both on the patient side and the doctor's side. The doctor saying, you know, how real is this? You know, not all docs, but some, you know, are you medication seeking? Is there, you know, ulterior motives here? Is there secondary gain, et cetera? So there's some mistrust there. And then on the patient's part, they, like you said, have a whole litany of docs they've tried before and medications, nothing worked. And the patient goes, you're not going to believe me, are you? Whether that's conscious or not. And so you're coming in with a lot of mistrust just inherent in that first session. And so this whole idea of establishing that relationship and believing the person. I heard you in a talk one time when someone asked about fibromyalgia, and the first thing you said that the medical doctor should say is, I'm sorry.
Apologies go a long way. I'll tell you, we owe our patients an apology. I tell my students that are sitting in the classroom, I say, you're part of the problem. And they sit with their big eyes, like, what do you mean? I said, the day you signed up for this thing called healthcare, you're part of the problem. So be part of the solution. It is very comforting for patients to know that you care. And I want you to understand, it's not a fake care. I'm just saying I care. The longer I get into this and study it, the more I can really, wow. Can you imagine you go day after day seeking help and nobody believes you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Scan upon scan upon scan upon drug upon injection. I cannot fathom what they got to go through.
Yeah. Yeah. So what you're talking about, your caring is genuine because you have this empathic understanding and real appreciation for what it's got to be like to be living their lives, not just in pain, but in the pursuit of relief.
Yeah.
So yeah, I see that understanding or that caring being genuine from that empathic attunement and understanding of what they've gone through to date.
Yeah. Biggest thing, I think, I'll be honest, in my early years, I was that provider. I was a mechanical yes, no, black and white. Yes. And what I have learned in the last 10, 15 years on how pain really works blew my mind. It changed my life. And I would encourage any healthcare provider, the neuroscience of pain, how pain works, is stunning. I mean, I had patients come to me years ago and say, when it's cold, I feel my back. I'm like, I'll move to Florida. And I mean no disrespect, right? It's like, I don't know what to do with you. And now we have Pfizer is spending $2 billion a year right now on drugs to calm your system down for a receptor that does that. But as a clinician, if I understand it, I can say, hey, let me tell you about these cool receptors in your back.
And
I can now show you that fifth grade kids in Wisconsin can sit there and go, I got it. And if people can got it, their lives are better for it. So for the healthcare providers, I really would encourage you to learn this stuff because it'll change your life. Because when you become empathetic, it helps your patient. And for me, this was a huge shift. The minute I understood it, I could help my patients understand it.
Really good. Really good. Hey, tell us about, for those that are interested, you know, in learning more about this, can you recommend some resources about you and learning about what you're doing and also behavior?
Yeah. So, I mean, I work for a company called Evidence in Motion, which is a seminar group. We teach post-professional courses for healthcare providers, and we teach therapists, psychologists, medical doctors, et cetera. For patients, we have booklets available, books that are written on these stories at Orthopedic Physical Therapy Products, OPTP.com. And then Behavior is the group we are working with. So BEHAVR, behavior.com, is the virtual reality company that we are partnered with to build some of these programs. So those are probably the easiest place to get a hold of me.
Very good. Very good. Well, it's been great to be with you today. You know what the cool part is, and as a takeaway from that, there is hope for those in pain, isn't there? And there's hope in treatments that aren't necessarily reliant solely upon medications the way that is typically done. And those can become addicting and increase one's sensitivity to pain. So all the things you're saying today, that we can actually train the brain and help the brain think about through the educational piece and also just the testing of one's limits and being able to push past those with some really awesome techniques and strategies.
Yeah.
Very, very hopeful. Sure appreciate, Adrian, you being with us today. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
And to those listening in, thanks for joining us. And we look forward to seeing you next time on Behavioral Health Today.
We appreciate all the support from our community. And if you like our show, one of the best ways you can support it is by giving us a 5-star rating and leaving a review. Behavioral Health Today is a podcast part of the Tribe Behavioral Health Network, all rights reserved.